Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today, in light of the many protests following the death of George Floyd at the hands of police in Minneapolis, we hear the story of a civil rights activist who has to come to terms with the actions of his grandfather in perhaps the most deadly race riot in U.S. history. But first, Planned Parenthood is making a comeback of sorts in Siouxland. In 2017, the Iowa legislature slashed funding for Planned Parenthood. Four clinics out of a dozen closed, including one in Sioux City. On Wednesday, June 3rd, the Sioux City Clinic reopened for limited operations. The Iowa State Executive Director for Planned Parenthood North Central States, Erin Davison Rippey, talked with Siouxland Public Media Sheila Brummer about this new update she says will provide needed care for women in the area.
We are just really glad to be able to, you know, fill a really crucial need at this time. COVID-19 has changed the healthcare landscape quite significantly. And so we really identified a need that we have some ability to fill. We'll continue to evaluate, you know, our ability to do this work in Sioux City. COVID-19 has made many things uncertain, but what we know is that we want to meet the needs of the community while we can.
And what kind of services can people find there?
Yeah, at the health center in Sioux City, we will offer STI testing and family planning services. So that includes birth control, IUD consultation, long-acting reversible contraceptives, depo shots, and more. And we will also offer medication abortion care through our telehealth system.
Now, I know when it comes to the topic of abortion, I think many people who are critical of Planned Parenthood, they always claim, well, that's the majority of what they do. And I know if you look at the stats, that's not the case.
Depending on kind of what you're in and how you're looking at those statistics, abortion accounts for around 3-5% of the services that we provide, a really crucial service that we provide to our communities, as we know that fewer and fewer providers are offering that service. So it is one service out of many services that we provide, and we're proud to be able to provide that service as a part of comprehensive reproductive health care.
Now, I know when you guys shut down your location, Woodbury County found that they were at the epicenter of kind of a surge of cases when it came to sexually transmitted disease.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's one of the things that since we were forced to close our Sioux City Health Center after the Iowa legislature defunded Planned Parenthood, we've continued to monitor that data very closely. And just recently, the Iowa Department of Public Health released their latest statistics, which go through the end of the calendar year 2019. And yes, as you said, Woodbury County has experienced a 74% increase in STI rates since 2017, which is just a staggering increase. And then when you consider the strains that COVID-19 has put on the healthcare system, we anticipate, and what public health experts tell us, is that with the advent of COVID-19, that is going to get a lot worse. What we know is that many providers just are not able to provide access to STI testing and treatment right now because they are needing to prioritize COVID-19 care. And so there's a significant gap in folks' ability to access STI testing and treatment. And we know that folks may not feel comfortable, always going into healthcare settings when they're concerned about the risk of COVID-19. So we're really glad to be able to help fill a gap in that access to STI testing, as well as, you know, we know that family planning access across the board in this area of the state is just, it's just a challenge.
How were you able to get the funding to reopen?
You know, we are continually evaluating kind of our abilities on the healthcare landscape. We have had some interest and some support from generous donors to be able to do some of this work. And, you know, some of it is just a commitment that Planned Parenthood is making to be able to fill a gap while we can. And again, we'll continue to evaluate this based on kind of the healthcare landscape in this area. But we are really grateful for some of that support that we have been able to receive to be able to reopen in Sioux City and offer these services while we can.
Actually, Planned Parenthood didn't go away here. I believe you still had some staff members?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so glad that you brought that up, that you are absolutely correct. We do still have health educators in the Sioux City community who work with a variety of different folks in the community to provide access to comprehensive evidence-based access to sexual health education. And we are so glad to still have that presence in the community. Obviously, like everyone else in this time, we've had to adapt our health education to meet the current challenges around COVID-19. And so we've been really innovative in how we're doing sex education and outreach in the community, which, you know, kind of leads me to another point I want to make sure to share with you is that, you know, as Planned Parenthood, as we have tackled this challenge with COVID-19, we really have evolved our healthcare services to meet the current need, particularly through standing up a whole bunch of telehealth services. So we fast-tracked the ability to provide many of our services now through telehealth, where folks can access those services from the comfort of their own home. And so, you know, that's a benefit that we can provide not only to folks in Sioux City, but folks across the entire state who may or may not have a Planned Parenthood health center in their community. So that's been a really important evolution that we have made during this time of COVID-19, whether it's healthcare or education or advocacy work. We're meeting the needs of the time and history that we're in.
Now, the clinic in Sioux City, it had served 2,300 patients the last full year it was open. How many of those patients do you think were left without a provider? Do you have any estimate, or I don't know if you have any data or any information you looked into?
Yeah. It's hard to know exactly because, you know, we don't have the ability to track directly where folks access care. We know that we have continued to see patients from the Sioux City area in other Planned Parenthood health centers around the state, particularly areas like Council Bluffs and Omaha. But, you know, when we look at the access to reproductive health care across the state, when Planned Parenthood was cut out of the state's family planning program and they sort of replaced it with a new program, what we know is that the number of Iowans accessing health care through that replacement program, the numbers plummeted. So, you know, only about half as many Iowans were receiving family planning services through that program. The number of services dropped 70%+. So, you know, we know that there continue to be unmet needs for access to family planning and sexual and reproductive health care, both in Sioux City and across the entire state of Iowa.
Do you know if there's a certain sector of the community really impacted by not having the service available to go in and see a provider?
Sure. You know, the part of what we did when we had previously been in the Sioux City community was to participate in a federal family planning program called Title 10. And that program really serves folks who have lower incomes. And, you know, when we were no longer able to be in Sioux City, you know, there are other providers that were participating in that program. So, you know, We know that we serve folks with lower incomes who may not have as many options in the community. You know, whether or not someone has insurance, we're able to work with folks on an individual basis to identify programs that might support them. Unfortunately, as Planned Parenthood, the Trump-Pence administration did cut us out of Title X, so that's not a program we're able to support patient access through. But we do work with patients on a individual basis to identify ways for them to access health care.
And that's Erin Davison-Rippey, Iowa State Executive Director for Planned Parenthood North Central States. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. After months of closed doors because of the coronavirus, starting Monday, June 15th, there will be curbside pickup at Perry Creek Branch Library. Library Director Helen Rigdon says patrons will have the opportunity to order and pick up their holds curbside at the Perry Creek Branch. This is how it will work.
It's contactless. It'll be only at the Perry Creek branch, and you'll have a 15-minute window to pick up your items. That's why we're scheduling them. And then staff will put your items out, and you will call when you get there, and then you'll come up and check to make sure it's your items, and then off you'll go.
So I imagine this is sort of a staged reopening. This looks like the first stage. How do you decide then, you know, going forward, when you sort of take the next step and the next step?
Well, we're kind of basing that on health and safety measures kind of specifically here in Woodbury County. But we also were having to wait until we got a lot of our safety gear in, including masks and hand sanitizer and fogger and disinfectant, and a lot of that stuff was back ordered, and we've just now been starting to receive it. So, and once the numbers look better, we will announce our reopening, and we're only going to at first reopen at the Morningside branch.
Oh, okay. So it wouldn't, that's the next stage, and then probably more the last stage would be opening the downtown branch?
Yes. The downtown branch has, well, and the one thing about libraries, we're such a hands-on, people touch everything. And also then, we do a lot of one-on-one interaction with the patrons. And so down here we have so many different nooks and crannies, and it would be almost impossible to keep each of those areas at less than 50% capacity, because it's not just in the building, what we were told by the state fire marshal, it's each area. So that's why Morningside's an easier place for the staff to police.
Yeah, it's a more open area, right?
It's open and will allow us to, kind of keep an eye and keep things kind of under control. One thing that also really is delaying us is the return of materials. We've got, a lot of people are like, well, why aren't you doing it in our, like restaurants? And we said, well, up to this point, we said, it's because of the items coming back. When you buy from a restaurant or even a grocery store, you take those home and you don't bring them back to the store. And so that's our problem, is we had to do a lot of research, and a lot of libraries, some organizations were doing, we were waiting on studies on how long we need to quarantine the items to make sure they're safe for staff to handle them, but to also put them back into circulation.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. I was reading your plan. I hadn't thought about, people have been touching these things, and so they need to be make sure they're clean and disinfected, right?
Right. We've got to put them in quarantine for 5 days before staff will really handle them, which kind of slows up the whole process. So, but we're trying just to make it a safe and, ensure a healthy place for both staff and the patrons. And, yeah, people don't realize that, people eat over their books and they sneeze on them and they cough on them. And, it's just, but they come back. So that's been a big concern and a big worry for us as we made these plans.
It really came home to me since all this started and everything shut down, how important a library is to Sioux City, to all of us who live here, whether it's books, media, a place to go and study, a place to meet up with people, reading for younger kids, a place for seniors, a place for political meetings. I mean, really and truly, anything and everything important to people seems to happen there now.
Yeah, we kind of feel like, you know, we're like a second home maybe for some people in the community. And it's been hard on us. It's so weird to be in the library and it's so quiet. It was I've been in here a lot of times when we've not been open, but during normal daytime hours, it would, you know, always be a hive of activity and, you know, families going in and out and people using the computers. And now it's just kind of quiet. And so we're really missing our patrons. And, you know, we can't wait to get back to serving them in some limited capacities as we move through this plan. But we're also a department of the city, so we had to coincide our plans kind of with the city, so we were all on the same page as far as reopening. I know I never want to go through another pandemic in the rest of my life, but and that we're trying to do the right thing, but we appreciate their patience, and then you know, and to be patient with us, because we're not going to come back at 100% the first day we open our doors. So it's going to be limited service, and you know, we just trying to keep people safe when we first reopen. So that's the main thing, is to try and bear with us.
That was Helen Rigdon, the director of the Sioux City Public Library, talking about the reopening of the library next Monday, June 15th, after months of being shut down to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. You can reserve books online and pick them up outside the Perry Creek branch on Hamilton Boulevard. Support for The Exchange comes from Gregory Giles, investment advisor representative with Legacy Financial LLC in Sioux City, serving the financial planning and investment needs of clients since 2004. Information about Legacy Financial and Greg Giles is available at legacyfinancialllc.com. Financial planning and advisory services offered through RDA Financial Network. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. George Floyd was laid to rest Tuesday in Houston, Texas. Since the death of the African-American man at the hands of police in Minneapolis, protesters have taken to the streets demanding justice. The relatively peaceful protests could not have been imagined 100 years ago, in the red summer of 1919. There were race riots in more than 20 cities and towns across the country. In the small town of Elaine, Arkansas, racial tensions turned to riots after African-American sharecroppers tried to unionize. 237 people were estimated to be hunted down and killed. Writer and civil rights activist J. Chester Johnson grew up not far from Elaine. As a child, he could not have imagined that a member of his own family took part in the bloodshed. In his new book, Damaged Heritage, The Elaine Race Massacre, and A Story of Reconciliation, Johnson illuminates the massacre and a friendship that helped him resolve his complicated feelings about his grandfather's role in the tragedy. Johnson heard stories about his grandfather's actions in the context of the integration of the Little Rock Central High School in 1957. Johnson says during car trips with his mother to go see his grandfather, he began to hear stories about what went on.
My mother used to tell me about this event in which my grandfather Lonnie participated in, where lots of African Americans died, and that it was just north of Deschutes County or McGee. But it registered, particularly she mentioned it several times, but I didn't investigate further than that. And then as I became aware of the writings of Ida B. Wells, I began to tie the two together, because after the treatise of the Arkansas Race Riot of 1919, I began to check what happened around that time in Southeast Arkansas? Were there a number of riots? Were there so-called or massacres? And there weren't. Yes, there were lynchings, and yes, some African Americans were burned alive, but it was either one or two. And there was only this one significant massacre that occurred within Phillips County, Deschutes County, Drew County, the nearby counties, but it was only in that part of Southeast Arkansas. There was just too much of this information for me to discount it. So I concluded that this was the event that my mother had described Lonnie had participated in.
And of course, you know, by the time you found out about this, your grandfather was, I'm assuming, you know, passed away.
Yes, he had. Yes, he had. But he was also a member of the Ku Klux Klan, and the family knew that. And, you know, he used to apparently, put a sheet and hood on and head out and come back several hours later and not tell anyone about what had transpired. But he was very different, apparently, with this particular event in Phillips County, that he told my mother and others in the family what had transpired. But he was long gone by the time I really got integrated into this to learn more and to write about it, which I wrote a very long article 5 years after learning about it, and it sort of spelled out Lonnie's role in the event.
And you've been working to try and have more reconciliation between the white and African American communities. What kind of things do you think would be helpful to try and overcome this huge amount of history that is, it almost feels like a weight, I would think.
Well, that's a wonderful way of describing it, a weight. In late 2013, a friend introduced me to a person named Sheila L. Walker. And Sheila was a descendant of several of the victims of the massacre.
Johnson says over time, he and Sheila committed themselves to racial reconciliation, and Sheila was the one who really moved that reconciliation forward.
We were different than those persons who participated in 1919. Certainly, I assumed I was different, and I wasn't going to have the same attitude or relate to African Americans the same way. And so Sheila and I began to not only talk about this event, but also commit ourselves to racial reconciliation. But beyond that, to extend into friendship and significant, and we became just very close, and our spouses became very close, and our two family, our children became close. And it would have never happened except for Sheila's very strong position. And she did it publicly and privately to us, that she forgave Lonnie. And it removed, and she did it sincerely. If without the forgiveness and without the clearing away of Lonnie's role, I don't know if we could have achieved the relationship and certainly the reconciliation that we achieved. And her view in the context of her saying she had forgiven Lonnie was a statement that people are born good, and it's only bad circumstances that cause good people to do bad things. And it was that attitude that allowed us to have this very special relationship and to move in a path that was very positive. it allowed us to reaffirm what I've always believed. I grew up in a racist region and a racist family, but I took a different view. And my view always has been, or at least certainly after, as I got into more mature state, was that the commonality between all people far exceeds the differences in custom and tradition and history and skin color and dialect or accent, and that we're all genuinely human. Sheila said publicly that, I have forgiven Lonnie more than Chester has. And she was exactly right.
Johnson says he's still not sure how he feels about his grandfather, Lonnie.
Well, I know he was a loving person to me. I adored him and growing up. And yet I realized he was also a gunman who participated in this terrible event. But I realize that I have not as fully forgiven Lonnie in the way that Sheila has. And in fact, I have this theory that in so many ways, white and black reconciliation has to take into account that whites have to be cleansed by and redeemed by those that we have made our victims. Now, I was not in Elaine, and I'm not talking about white guilt. I obviously didn't participate in Elaine. But on the other hand, I inherited this. This damaged heritage came to me. And if I didn't deal with it, it would be something that I would foist off on the future. And I made a commitment to myself that this was going to be something I would deal with. There was an African-American man in Phillips County, which was the site of the massacre, who said at one point when we were working on the memorial, he said, we keep sweeping all of this under the rug because there had never been a memorial, and there was a real desire for people just not to talk about it. He said, we keep sweeping this under the rug, but then we stumble over the rug. And that's what I hope that I'm not a party in continuing. So there's been an extrapolation, if you will, in my attitude toward black-white relationship that has grown out of this experience.
When Johnson wrote an article about his grandfather's participation in the massacre, he found himself referring to it as likely participation, and that surprised him.
And then I realized that there was no excuse for me to use this sort of ameliorative word of likely, and that I had to accept the fact that he participated in it. And it taught me a lesson that there is this whole history. You mentioned sort of a weight of this history on us. And the only way that we've sort of dealt with damaged heritage is through this excessive veneration of the past and tradition. And that's what, that's what I was doing. I was not admitting that Lonnie participated in it. By the use of the word likely, we push forward this damaged heritage, which creates the repetition of black subjugation and racism that exists from generation to generation. But that was the only way we could tolerate, we as whites, that's the only way we could tolerate the fact that we treated blacks this way.
That was J. Chester Johnson, poet, essayist, and translator. He's the author of Damaged Heritage, The Elaine Race Massacre, and A Story of Reconciliation. He's written extensively on race and civil rights, composing the litany for the National Day of Repentance when the Episcopal Church formally apologized for its role in transatlantic slavery and related evils. Johnson's grandfather took part in perhaps the largest and deadliest race riot in U.S. history in 1919, where hundreds of African-American men were killed. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. The incarceration of African-American men continues today. Americans are locked in prisons across the country, often for nonviolent drug crimes. Crime has always been an interest for writer Jim Reese. Reese is an associate professor of English and the director of the Great Plains Writers Tour at Mount Marty College in Yankton, South Dakota. In his new book of essays called Bone Shock, Reese talks about his interest in crime and his work in prisons in South Dakota and in California. Reese says he's always been interested in criminals and why they do what they do.
I've spent the last 2.5 years doing ride-alongs with the police in my small city, and I took the Citizens Academy. I passed that, and I'm actually in the process of becoming a reserve officer. So I want to write about crime on the front end. I mean, I want to see crime on the front end. And I've been working in prisons for 13 years, so I see what happens after crime is committed, and I have ideas. But just to get a better understanding, because I think there's just so, just like if you say the word inmate, if you say the word professor, if you say the word cop, there are these preconceived notions people have, and most of the time they're wrong. You know, I've been working with these cops and just observing them and writing about them. And they're just amazing. I couldn't keep my cool like they do in situations that they go into. They are some of the most professional men and women I've ever seen. And I've joked, I said, even if you paid me double what you guys did, I don't know if I could do it. And a lot of times they'll say, well, this has nothing to do with the money. And in fact, so I really like interviewing them and talking to them and watching them. And it's all part of this book that my next project that I'm working on. So it is really interesting.
It does kind of sound like you have, like most of us do, kind of two feelings about prisoners. You understand they've had problems. You understand that maybe they didn't have a good life growing up, but you also understand the danger implicit there, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to understand it. Yeah, when I first started doing this, I thought there was an answer. Like, I'm gonna find an answer, and I kept writing these big, it kept adding to this manuscript. So the book Bone Chalk that just came out, I had this whole other book on crime that I was working on, and one of the publishers that was interested in the book said, and this is before I had gone with Stephen F. Austin State University Press, they said, hey, do you have some other stuff you're working on? We might ask you for some more essays. And I said, I do have this big crime essay or this big crime book I'm working on. And it was very academic. And I was working with some editors at the time, some friends of mine, specifically Kent Meyer, who's a great fiction writer. And he said, instead of writing this essay or adding an essay, what I did is I took that manuscript and I condensed it down to 35 pages. He said, instead of worrying about being so academic, why don't you think about how crime has affected you and write it from that perspective and forget about all the sources and citing things. So I kept a few sources in there. Like, I think for your listeners, one of the most important ones for all of us to understand is one in every three Americans of working age in America has some sort of criminal record. Now, if you understand that, and you understand that we have 5% of the world's population, but we house 25% of the world's inmates, that's something else that people should know. It's crime affects almost everybody, and the way we're going about things hasn't worked. I think there's a lot of addiction issues in the country, and mental health issues, and locking people up is not the answer.
I was interested reading the book, how you kind of juxtapose your memories as a child in Omaha when this babysitter was brutally killed and the child lived, was not involved in the violence, but then the killer was apprehended, went to jail, go ahead 20 some years. They're going to have hearings to see whether, you know, this person would get paroled. And then you talk about having kids yourself and how this, you know, and then you think about the dangers in the world. It's just an interesting juxtaposition.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, it's for a long time, I thought about how that crime affected all of us in high school. You know, Christina was a friend of mine, you know, and I didn't know for a long time. I wrestled with, well, can I write about this? I mean, can I talk about this? And I didn't know exactly what to say. And so it took a long time to figure out what to say. But then when it came back up in the news that he was being retried because he was a juvenile when he committed the crime, that really upset me and a lot of people. It was a very heinous crime. And, you know, you can read about it in the book. But I wanted us to talk about that because what I've learned also from working in various prisons, whether it be San Quentin Prison or Federal Prison Camp Yankton or the women's prison in Pierce, South Dakota, all of these places, heinous criminals, there's just not a, it's such a small percentage. What we do in our criminal justice system is lock up so many people. In the federal system, almost 50% of the people incarcerated are incarcerated for drug-related crimes. So the amount of people that commit heinous crimes in federal prison, and I'm not talking about federal and state, but I'm talking about federal, is about 3% or under. Just under 3%. So, you know, we see and maybe even have been, you know, somehow heinous crimes have affected people or even me or, you know, people in my high school. But we're also need to look at the bigger picture too. But I thought it was important to write about it all because, you know, yeah, I am a parent, and I mean, and I'm a human being, you know. Things scare me still, but also I want to, while I'm here, try to do the best I can and educate people and let them know what I'm seeing, which is not what you see on The Blacklist or some show.
In the book, you talk about having to sign a document, you know, before you went in. It talks about how they will not negotiate for you if you become a hostage. I've never heard of something like that. I imagine, though, they would have to have, you would have to sign something like that if you go to San Quentin.
Yeah, that was pretty nerve-wracking the first year we started going there. I think we went there consecutively for 4 or 5 years, and I remember looking at that waiver and thinking, okay, is this really worth it? And if you're in, and then if you believe everything you see on TV or you start Googling San Quentin, it can be pretty scary. What's interesting about San Quentin, and that just goes for all the California state prisons, though, when you go into work in them, it's just a waiver that you have to sign, and it's a legal document because if something like that happens, then, you know, I guess they're off the hook. But it's, you know, San Quentin actually is a very, very interesting, probably one of, I think, one of the most interesting prisons I've ever been in the country, just because of the unique arts programming that they have going on and how much it's even gotten better. I mean, they have their own podcast now that is recorded from inside San Quentin. They have their own college and that kind of stuff. What I've learned now after 13 years is what's really making sense. I mean, if you can educate human beings, a lot of people that just didn't go to school or never had a chance to go to school for various reasons, or, you know, that's really the key to turning our justice system around. Education is key. It's very simple. You know, when people have an education, they're less likely to go back to prison. It gives them something to work for and things like that. So it's a really interesting place, San Quentin is.
You also talk about how you were just casually saying hello, how are you doing, to an inmate, and you were told you were never supposed to be doing that there.
Yeah. It's hard to be a teacher and not, you know, also be a human being. So I've been different prisons I've been in. I've been welcomed and not welcomed. Let's say that as a school teacher, you know, because that's what I am. I have one job. My job is not to go in there and worry about why people are in there. My job is to go in there and be a teacher and try to teach them what I can. I'm not the judge and jury. And some people that I've noticed when I've gone to various prisons don't feel that way. They prisons are supposed to be about rehabilitation.
Right. And they tend to not achieve that, though, as we've seen in the U.S.
Some don't take that, I think, as seriously as they need to.
I know I've asked you a lot about your writing about prison work and et cetera, but you also tell a lot of stories about just regular people in the Midwest, and you capture kind of day-to-day life and what it's like, and without looking down on anybody, which often happens. I find people write about small towns, not just the Midwest, but all over the place, but you capture the people, but you don't necessarily do it with, you're not sitting there saying, oh, aren't they funny?
I don't know. I love hanging out with people, you know, and I'm a city kid that married into a farm family. So it was very, and that has to do, there's a lot of essays in the book about that. So it's a big transition, and what I learned from hanging out with various people was very interesting to me, and how much I thought I knew and didn't know. And, you know, I mean, I hung around with my brother-in-laws that called me Bucket Calf because I just wouldn't leave them alone. And I would follow them around because I wanted to know what it was like. And I thought if I was going to write about that, if I was going to write about rural America, which I now was living in, you know, I had to get my hands dirty. And I remember somebody saying, hey, if you want to be a writer, you want to write about this stuff, go back to college and get a job during the summer working on somebody else's farm, you know. And I just kind of laughed. And then I was like, okay, I will. And I did. And that's one of the essays in the book, too. The second week I was working at the place, I drove a John Deere 3020 into the side of this guy's building. And he let me keep my job. So it was pretty remarkable that he let me stay on the farm. And I just thought I can drive this. It's got to be just like a car. And it wasn't. So, I mean, I think that immersion in your storytelling, I'm a big believer in gonzo journalism. I'm a big believer in, like I said, immersing yourself in the story before you try and tell it.
That is supposed to be a big part of what journalists are able to do, although there doesn't seem to be enough people or enough time anymore to really get involved, you know. You write about so many different things. Is there anything that in particular you've been wanting to write about that you haven't been able to write about yet?
I'm a nonfiction writer, so I'm very conscious about if I'm going to write about somebody or something, that I want to make sure that I'm doing them justice. I'm not just... the story should be always about discovery and not about display. And so I don't think there's anything that I'm afraid to write about or I haven't written about. It's, it's a matter of just trying to stay focused instead of writing about 100 things.
That was author Jim Reese. His new book is called Bone Chalk. Jim Reese is an associate professor of English and the director of the Great Plains Writers Tour at Mount Marty College in Yankton, South Dakota. Reese has spent many years teaching writing at prisons in South Dakota and also at San Quentin Penitentiary in California. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. As protesters march and our country again grapples with the history of discrimination, Jim Skop looks back to the early days of Siouxland, a time that was no less challenging.
The Grave of Little Crow. When he was a kid, his father was killed when a rifle somehow discharged. A bloody fight for leadership ensued between him and his brother, and Little Crow was wounded in both wrists, scarring his arms so badly he kept them covered for his entire life. But he became the leader of a band of Dakota into which he was born. Some would say he caved in 1851 when he signed the treaty at Traverse des Sioux, thereby consigning his people to a thin strip of reservation land along the Minnesota River. He took to wearing white men's clothes, joined a church, started to farm. He visited Washington, a trip which shook the temerity out of dozens of Native warriors. Pictures of Little Crow show him to be just another white pioneer. But he wasn't. He was a leader of his Dakota people. When obligations weren't fulfilled and his people were starving, he chose war, even though he was against it. When he did, he went all in, as leaders do. He is the only man buried in the cemetery at River Bend Church, Flandreau, South Dakota, who has a war named after him, Little Crow's War. Today, people call what happened 150 years ago the Dakota War of 1862. But Little Crow's War is also a fitting description, even though he knew himself it wouldn't end well. To avoid what was to come, he and others fled to Canada when the fighting ceased. Therefore, he was not among the 30-some hung at Mankato in December of 1862, the largest mass hanging in American history. But soon he returned home and was killed in a gunfight when two white settlers stumbled on him and his son. For a time, no one knew who lay there dead in the grass. No matter, he was, after all, an Indian. So his body was dragged up and down the streets, firecrackers set off in his eyes and ears before his head was cut off. Those who killed him got $75 for his scalp. One was cited by the legislature for honorable service. Eventually, those scarred wrists identified him as Little Crow, chief of the Dakota, whose warriors killed almost 500 settlers, men, women, and children, slaughtered him. Years later, his remains were given to a grandson. And right there in the cemetery at River Bend Presbyterian Church, his remains are today, one hopes, at rest. The inscription on his stone is part of the reason he's still regarded by some as a hero. In August of 1862, Little Crow knew what was going to happen once Dakota warriors raided the agency that wouldn't give them food that belonged to them. He knew a fight would not end well, but he led his warriors anyway. Therefore, I'll die with you. You can read that line on his gravestone, bottom line. Stop by sometime. Chances are, his stone is the only one bearing a name you might have heard of. Little Crow's story is staggering in every way. He led a rebellion that slaughtered what a white man like me can't help thinking of as innocent people. Immigrant homesteaders, whole families, some of whom actually knew him. Some attended the same church. But Little Crow was to some, to many, a great hero. And still is. And you don't have to believe that to be true. But if you can't believe it, you really should try to understand it anyway. River Bend Church is not so far from here, but you gotta hunt to find it. I don't know of a tour bus that would take you anywhere close. You're very much on your own. But a story like Little Crow's in this fair Sioux land of ours is really never all that far away, no matter where you are. And I find that humbling, whether or not I'm walking in a cemetery.
So support for Small Wonders on Siouxland Public Media comes from the Daniels Osborne Law Firm in the Ho-Chunk Center in downtown Sioux City, serving the needs of clients in real estate transactions, business formation and guidance, and personal estate planning. More information is available on Facebook or at danielsosborne.com. And that's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. Thanks so much to Sheila Brummer and Steve Smith for their help with the show. I'm Mary Hartnett. We'll see you next week.